Hello, I'm Stephen Fry, a trustee of the Royal Academy of Arts, and very proud to be so. Welcome to our podcast.
For those of us, I feel a bit diffident, is somebody who works primarily on the art of China's past rather than China's present, but I hope that these thoughts can at least help us to think about the material in the Ai Weiwei exhibition in one of the many possible broader contexts in which we might want to situate it. So what do I mean by the stuff of Chinese art? Do I mean a distinctive set of materials which are associated only with China? And what would those materials be? Would they, for example, be ink? Very much situated today by one strand of contemporary Chinese art as the Chinese material par excellence and something which gives us some sort of access to a particular Chineseness. Perhaps outside China, we might not surprisingly think of porcelain as a specifically Chinese material, or we might think of jade, or we might think of bronze. All of these materials have been used in China. None of them is unique to China, although some of them were developed there. Porcelain, for example, was developed there. But what does it mean to take these materials and try and think about the work of Ai Weiwei in relation to that? Now, is it justifiable to stand up here and talk about Ai Weiwei in relation to the art of the past, or particularly of the deep past, at all? He himself has said, and I'm quoting, "I'm contemporary by definition, but I definitely speak art historical languages too." So there's a certain amount of justification coming from the artist himself for what I'm doing today, but as we'll see, you know, what the artist says about himself is maybe not the be-all and end-all. There's a slightly more kind of problematic way of looking at this, in that I think that Chinese art has often been talked about, particularly outside China, as somehow an art historical art, an art that is particularly invested in, obsessed with reworking its own past. So if we look at a jade and a porcelain object which are separated by thousands of years, but which are clearly the same shape, and clearly the people in 1000 AD who made this porcelain object were very deliberately reworking this Neolithic jade object in a different material. I mean, there's actually a technical word for this. It's called skeuomorphism. Skeuomorphism is when you make one thing in the material normally associated with another material, and that's what we're seeing a lot of in Ai Weiwei's work. He's famous for making things out of materials that they're not usually made out of. So things that are normally made out of rubber are made out of jade, or things that are normally made out of metal are made out of marble. So that there's a sort of technical term for that. And, you know, making things out of other things is very much sort of in the catalogue. It's something that Ai Weiwei himself talks about. So this would be a classic example of skeuomorphism, the making of a baby's pushchair out of marble, obviously, in doing so, completely removing any kind of functionality that the thing might originally had. And we might note in passing that Ai Weiwei owns a chunk of a marble quarry, but then so did Michelangelo. So are we, you know, is this relationship to the art of the past a realistic thing to do? If we want to, and, you know, people like me are paid to come up with ingenious connections between things, you know, if we wanted to, we could say, well, Ai Weiwei is an artist whose artwork, often one artwork is made up of lots of little things. So the sunflower seeds that we saw at the Tate a couple of years ago, enormous quantities of single objects, but it's one artwork. And there are a large number of his works that partake of what you might call this art of assemblage. So this 2013 work called Baby Formula, or the Map of China, which we see in his work again and again, is made out of tins of baby milk, precisely at the moment that there was a big scandal in China about the safety of baby formula. And a work like Bang from 2013, Again, this is something that is made up of, we would recognize that there are lots of units, that there are many, many stools here, but it's the sheer quantity of them that make it something, that make the work of art. Now, this is something that we might see in the work of other contemporary Chinese artists, if we wanted to make that connection. And I'm showing you here a work called Chinese Bible, by an this is an installation in Australia, a work by an artist called Yang Zhi Chao, who's of a slightly younger generation, 6 years younger than Ai Weiwei, but they've been friends and known one another for a long time. And what Yang Zhi Chao did here is assemble 3,000 notebooks and diaries, which he bought from flea markets and antique stalls and so on. These particular little red notebooks that were used in the Cultural Revolution period as diaries. And the contents are very various. Some of them are kind of people's political study, but they also include shopping lists and very sort of everyday, quotidian, personal things like that. So here's another work of art which is made up of lots of little things. And if we wanted to come back to this, I could stand here and say, well, one of the things about traditional Chinese art, and I'm kind of deliberately doing the scare quotes there, is that you have the kind of basic unit is the brushstroke. There's a Chinese technical term for this, which goes back a very long way, tsun. A tsun is an individual kind of brushstroke, and there are many different kinds of tsun, and there's a highly developed technical vocabulary for talking about them. And a work like this, painted at the very end of the 15th century, connoisseurship would say, well, this is a work which is made up of lots of these tsun, and so the kind of work that we're seeing here, if we take each stool as being equivalent to a brush stroke, there's a continuity between this traditional Chinese art and what Ai Weiwei does today. Now, I could say that, but there's a problem in saying that, and there's a problem which I'd wish to underline for you by showing you two pictures. So this is a thing that I would typically do with students at the beginning of a course on 20th century Chinese art. I'd show them this picture painted in 1921, and I'd show them this picture painted in 1921, and I would say, which of these pictures is more Chinese, and which of these pictures is more modern? Now, in a sense, this is obviously a trick question. They were both painted by Chinese artists in China, in 1921, neither of the artists, incidentally, had ever left China at this point. So they were artists who had received their entire kind of artistic training within China. So the problem with this, or what makes it a trick question, is that it sort of puts Ai Weiwei in the great tradition of Chinese artists. I mean, one way he does relate to the artists of the past, and particularly to the artists of this early 20th century period, is that he's one of the Chinese artists who's being told by Western critics that their art isn't Chinese enough. A review of the exhibition, or rather it was a preview of the exhibition, which appeared in the British press, said, well, Ai Weiwei is the perfect artist for kind of lazy Western curators, and the reason that he's popular is entirely because his work is plugged into a tradition descending back to Duchamp in the early 20th century, a tradition that's familiar, and because he's familiar, he's therefore popular. There's a lazy piece of history there. Because of these two pictures painted in the same year of 1921, what kind of reception did they get at the time? Or really, what kind of reception have they had since then in terms of our understanding of what we might want to call modern Chinese art? The problem with this picture is that it looks pretty Chinese, but it gets defined as not modern. I mean, despite the artist who painted this, a man called Chen Hengke, was very kind of au courant with global contemporary art trends, and he writes this passage in which he says, well, once upon a time, and we might look at what's on the walls here, Once upon a time, European painting was about capturing what things looked like. But now, he's writing in the early 1920s, that's not what Europeans do. Look at Cubism, look at Futurism. You know, that's what they're doing now. Art is about expressing what the artist really feels. And we've been doing that for thousands of years. So this is modern Chinese art, but he can't make that stick. That has not stuck over the centuries, over the decades. Well, it's a century now, but over the decades since this. So this gets called, and this would have probably shocked the man who painted it, this gets called traditional Chinese art. The problem with this is entirely opposite. It looks modern in terms of 1921, but it doesn't look Chinese, and it gets categorized as derivative. It's all very well, but it's just a bit like Matisse. It's a pale imitation of Matisse in the way that some critics have said, well, Ai Weiwei is a pale imitation of Duchamp. So this can be modern, and after all, you know, in 1921, this is much more modern than the art which was approved by this institution, the Royal Academy, in 1921, which was very much digging its heels in against anything that smacked of post-impressionism. So, you know, it's pretty modern for 1921, but it isn't Chinese. So that's the problem of that I have as I stand here. If I tell a story about Ai Weiwei's connections with brushstroke technologies of the Ming period, I'm making him very Chinese, but I'm subverting his claims to be contemporary. And if I address his connections to Duchamp, then I'm undermining his Chineseness. Now, I'm not the first person to spot this problem, and in fact, I would suggest that contemporary Chinese artists are very much more aware of this problem than I am, or than any one of us is. This is the framing in which all of their work is situated. It has particular inflections in particular cases, so it works out one way in the case of Ai Weiwei, but it's essentially the problem that all contemporary Chinese artists face. So if we look at this work, the art book, which is in the exhibition. Now, of course, you know, one of the sort of piquant things about it is that in the English edition published by Feiden, Ai Weiwei appears, you know, it appears here immediately before Albers. But in the Chinese edition, which Feiden must have licensed, and frankly, shame on them, the Ai Weiwei gets left out, and Agostino Di Duccio becomes the artist who comes immediately before Albers. But I think there's a more profound point. For me, there's a more profound point here than simply something about, you know, political censorship or leaving. It's like, how if there's the art book, one book of kind of Chinese art, how is China to be fitted into this? Because although this book contains contemporary Chinese art, it doesn't contain the art of the past. It doesn't contain Shenzhou or Wen Zhengming or Shi Tao or Dong Qichang or any of the other kind of major canonical names that I could reel off purely to everybody's mystification, and what would be the point? You know, so the question of kind of, are we dealing with one art? This is not a comfortable or an easy question, and I don't think there's an answer to it. But he is in that great tradition, therefore, which it goes back to the early 20th century, of Chinese artists who have been told by Western critics that their art isn't Chinese enough. There's another way, I suppose, in which we might want to, again, you know, here's another tale that I could spin if I wanted to, about, you know, politics and Chinese art. I mean, it's often thought that, you know, Chinese painting of the pre-modern period has no relationship to politics, that it's associated with kind of sensibilities and things, but actually there's a considerable history of early 15th century artists getting into trouble for painting figures in red robes when that kind of person wasn't supposed to have a red robe. And certainly in the 20th century, here's a work from the middle of the 20th century called Images of Today by Ding Zong, and it includes If you can see towards the kind of left-hand edge, there's a figure of an artist holding up a painting of a rather sort of mangy wolf. And he's bedizened with prizes, which he's awarded by the state, but he's blindfolded. He can't see the corruption and the chaos and the misery of wartime China. So that kind of political engagement, this is not something that no Chinese artist has ever done before. Similarly, the reworking of things. So this is what's called a New Year picture, a Nianhua, a kind of popular poster distributed at the Chinese New Year. And this is one which Ai Weiwei himself distributed on the internet. And a couple of years back, I'm afraid I can't remember which one. Obviously, we've got kind of the self-portrait in the form of gods, but we've also got the kind of imagery of a sort of personal and private imagery. So we've got the crabs that we see in the exhibition, the hexie, the river crabs that are a pun on this word, harmony, which is the state's big highest virtue. And we've got down in the bottom left-hand corner, you can see the alpaca, the grass mud horse, which sounds like a very, very rude Chinese word indeed. Now these posters. So here's one from the early 20th century. This is what these kind of posters looked like for centuries. But long before Ai Weiwei, or at least kind of in the decades before Ai Weiwei was born, the kind of taking and appropriating of this form for political aims was widespread. So what you've got here are two posters produced in the communist base area of Yan'an, showing, instead of the kind of traditional gods that are going to protect us from evil influences, the kind of communist militias and communist troops who are going to kind of preserve us from the Japanese. So this sort of reworking, this taking, appropriating, melding and reworking, which we see in Ai Weiwei's work quite clearly, is again something that we could, if we wanted to, associate with the past. There are very particular histories that I think we need to grasp in order to understand this work, and obviously those are the histories of 20th century China, but also the kind of personal history of Ai Weiwei, but also the very specific history of the generation immediately before Ai Weiwei. And one of the things I wanted to talk about, because I don't think it's often understood enough, is the degree of cosmopolitanism in socialist China in the decade and a half between the communists coming to power in 1949 and the outbreak of the Cultural Revolution in 1966. The coming to power of the communists in 1949 severed China's connections with, certainly with the United States, and to a lesser degree with Western Europe, but by no stretch of the imagination with the rest of the world. So the picture that I'm showing you, the gentleman on the far left is the Chilean painter José Venturelli, and standing next to him is Ai Qing, Ai Weiwei's father, famous poet born in 1910, who in the very early years of the People's Republic was a very kind of highly esteemed figure. He has his arm around this very elderly man called Chi Bai-shi, a famous painter in the so-called national painting style, Guo Hua painting style, and then another poet, Emi Xiao. Chi Bai-shi is something of an icon of this cosmopolitanism. The man circled in the photograph in the upper left, Konstantin Maximov, a Soviet painter who spent time in the 1950s in China and ran oil painting classes. And even Western Europe is not, the art worlds of Western Europe and China are not completely separated, because here is Chi Bai-shi with our very own Stanley Spencer, RA, who visited China in 1954. So although Ai Weiwei spent his very early life, I mean, he was a baby when his father was purged exiled first to the remote northeast and then to the deserts of Xinjiang. So he himself had never experienced this kind of socialist cosmopolitanism, this third world cosmopolitanism where there are poets from Cairo and Indian painters and so on passing through China in the early 1950s. But that was the milieu very much in which his father's political culture was formed. Ai Weiwei starts out as a picture maker. He starts out as a maker of pictures. Here's one of his works from 1979. And it was presumably work not so different from this that he was showing as a member of the Stars Group, the first kind of unofficial group. But remember that he, just as Michel Foucault famously missed May 68, he wasn't in Paris in 1968, he was teaching in Tunisia. So Ai Weiwei missed 1989, he missed Tiananmen Square. The association of art making with political activism, which goes back to the Stars movement, is something that he took with him when he left China and headed for the United States. Now, he himself has said, actually, before 2000, I didn't make much artwork. There was no need to call myself an artist. But I find this sort of very hard to believe. He was a maker of pictures, a maker of representations out of things. And this portrait of Duchamp is actually nothing like a Duchamp. Ai Weiwei has said, I think Duchamp is the most, if not the only, influential figure in my so-called art practice. We all benefit from what he's done. But this is an object transformed. It's beaten out of shape and into shape at the same time. It ceases to be a coat hanger at the very precise moment that it becomes a portrait. So there's all kinds of sort of experimenting going on in the work that he does kind of in the United States, work like this, which is very, very different non-figurative work. But he misses 1989. He isn't there, this kind of iconic moment, this iconic moment of Chinese culture, which circulates on the internet in memes like this. You know, this is so clearly a sort of joke redoing of the man standing in the famous photograph of the man standing in front of the tank in Tiananmen. Instead, he's in New York. Here he is scowling and channeling Andy Warhol at the same time. And you have to admit that an ability to scowl and channel Andy Warhol at the same time is sort of pretty impressive. He's there at a point of when New York bulks very large in Chinese culture. He's in China, for example, when Glenn Tsao's novel Beijing Renzai Niu Yue, a Beijing man, a Beijinger in New York, is the succès fou, a mad success in Chinese. And then it's made into a TV series in 1993. It's like China came to a stop when this was on the telly. The streets were deserted. Everybody watched this fantastic kind of soap opera. But he was actually there. So in a sense, when he goes back to China, the cultural capital of New York is something that he trails with him. And that's both the cultural capital of his exposure to high Western modernism, here he is with Duchamp, and the sort of dregs of society sense. Here he is kind of, you talking to me, I think, is what we're getting in this photograph. Here he is working as a portrait artist in Times Square in the 1980s. Now, one of the things that it seems to me that Ai Weiwei is very contemporary about is the scale of his work. His work is often very, very big. This is a work called Forever Bicycles, shown in Taipei in 2011. It was a sort of immersive bicycle experience. But you might say that, again, it's the socialist state that makes the possibilities for much bigger art. So this painting from the 1950s is massively bigger than any Guo Hua landscape painting has ever been before. It's 9 meters across and 5 meters high, and it sits in the Great Hall of the People. And this interest in scale and proportion and the sizes of things, making things big, making things little, that seems to me to be a theme that runs through the work. I think that's the point of this series of images, the Studies in Perspective series, here with the White House and here more or less randomly, because he's an equal opportunity insulter. So this is him, this is the Parliament building in Helsinki. You know, what has Ai Weiwei got against the Parliament, but what against the Finnish Parliament? You know, we don't know. But it actually is a study. It is what it says it is at the same time as it's the joke. It is a study in perspective. So now let me get to the issue of materials. It seems to me that the materials that he uses, there's a distinction here to be made between clean stuff and messy stuff. And this isn't about abjection, it seems to me. This is not about abjection. And that's what differentiates it from a lot of the Chinese avant-garde art that was developing tentatively in the decades while he was out of China. So this work, like, in, you know, very, very early on Gu Dexin's installation. Gu Dexin at this point worked in a plastics factory and hence had access to this kind of extruded materials, which have these kind of visceral, unpleasant qualities. Even the painting, some of the painting of the period, has this very kind of messy and abject quality. And a work like this, Huang Yongping's A History of Chinese Painting and a Short History of Modern Painting After 2 Minutes in the Washing Machine, which is a work which did exactly what it said on the tin. He took two textbooks that were in use in Chinese art schools at the time, one of them A History of Chinese Painting, one of them Herbert Reed's History of Modern Western Art, and here he is actually putting them in his heavy kind of spin cycle. There's a whole kind of strand of abjection of the body art, which is very pervasive, again, during the period when Ai Weiwei was outside China and just after he'd returned. So he was actually the photographer of this performance piece, 65 kilos by Zhang Huan, in which he hangs himself from the roof with one of his veins cut open and blood dripping onto a hot plate underneath, so that there's a kind of sizzling and a horrible smell at the same time. Or work like this, Sun Yan and Peng Yu's Civilization Pillar, which is an entire pillar made out of liposuction fat. And it's made out of liposuction fat from a very particular procedure, very common in China nowadays, which is the operation on the folds of the eye designed to make your eyes look rounder and hence more Western. And they gathered this fat, this human fat. I hope everybody's had their lunch. There are photographs of them doing this, but don't worry, I've saved them. I'll save them for students. But this is very visceral, very messy, very kind of nasty, nasty material. You know, and it reaches its climax in the exhibition in 2000 with this kind of dual title and this very kind of different dual title, so that the Chinese Buhezofangshi, an uncooperative approach, says one kind of thing, and the English title says one very kind of different sort of thing. And this is the exhibition in which body parts and fetuses and all kinds of unbelievably unpleasant kind of abject treatment of the human body was engaged in. Now, a lot of his work is clearly about destruction. It's about the destruction. You know, we tend to drag that back to the past, but I think Chinese critics who kind of, both Chinese critics who like Ai Weiwei's work and Chinese critics who don't like Ai Weiwei's work, tend not to always make the historical associations that Western critics make and that I'm sort of both making and trying to kind of problematize for you here. So, you know, smashing, breaking, we associate that with the destruction of the Cultural Revolution, with the visual art of the Cultural Revolution, but it's at least as much to do with the massive kind of economic development of China today. So I'm just showing you a picture from the Chinese media this year of the Ren Mansion in Zhengzhou. This is now a much celebrated case of a historic mansion which basically is in the wrong place, and property developers would like it swept away, and the Wren family are kind of holding out and attempting to preserve it. So that's an association not with the past, but very much kind of with the present day of China. And it's a tearing down in order to build something. That makes it, you know, in a way much more difficult. I mean, he's been a great builder, hasn't he? You know, builder of studios. And he's arrived at this sort of position where he is the boss man, the big figure. In 2007, Li Jianyang, a contemporary artist, made this life-size diorama of figures, Rent Collection Courtyard, which was itself a parody of a 1999 artwork, which was itself a parody of a Cultural Revolution period artwork, showing in clay figures the sort of evil landlord. So here we have Joseph Beuys and Mao gaze into the future together. Here we have the corpse of Harold Seyman, the curator, Harold Seyman, curator of the Venice Biennale, being borne away, while Ai Weiwei is, you know, the boss. Here's Uli Sig, the great Swiss collector of contemporary Chinese art, pushing the wheelbarrow, and Ai Weiwei is cast in the figure of the evil landlord. You know, there's clearly, the Mickey is being taken. He has to be able to take it as well as dish it out. But he's not an artist whose work has sold for huge prices on the international art market. I mean, these figures are a few years out of date, but these are the top-selling contemporary artists by value in the year 2011 and 2012. And you'll see several Chinese names on this list, people who've sold their work for colossal prices. But these are figures very much in the tradition of painting rather in the tradition of the work that he's doing. So clean stuff versus kind of messy stuff. Woodworking. So let's just think about some of the things that he's used. I think there's an issue here about making and labor, and in particular gendered labor. So here are the male kinds of carpenters who work on woodwork, and here are the female industrial workers who at Jingdezhen created the 100 million or however many it was sunflower seeds. So there's a kind of gendered labor thing going on here that I think we need to forget, that we need to not forget. This interest in having, craftsmen do things for you. There's a lot of that in contemporary Chinese art. This is the 1999 version of Venice's Rent Collection Courtyard. And a lot of contemporary artists in China and outside China have homed in on the village of Dafen. The village of Dafen is part of the city of Shenzhen in South China, is the center of the global oil painting industry. You know, if you want a hand-painted copy of a Renoir for a hotel hallway, this is where it goes. So the artist Liu Ding got hundreds of these same pictures, and this is Michael Richter's series Real Fake Art, in which he went round a Dafen and got artists to pose with the European modernist works that they were creating. There's a further twist to this in that we've subsequently learned that the people posing with these works hadn't painted them, most of them at all. And in fact, they were all painted by one guy who had then kind of put the work out to other people, but that a man called Yin Xiuzhi painted all of them himself. So coming back to the specifics of certain materials, let's just sort of think about wood for a little bit. I used to be a curator of furniture in the Victoria and Albert Museum. This kind of Chinese furniture of this kind was the sort of stuff I worked on, and indeed one of my first books was a book about Chinese furniture of this kind. And what struck me looking at them again as I walked around the exhibition just before giving this lecture was they looked to me like they'd always been like that. They didn't look to me like objects that had been manipulated. Now, of course, they have been manipulated, cut in half and readjusted and so on. But they have a particular I mean, the connoisseurship of these things is very much, when I used to kind of have to tell whether a thing was old or new by looking at it, the kind of close attention to the joints and so on, are the signs of reworking, are the signs of remodeling. That was what you had to kind of pay a great deal of attention to. Reworking could be, used in all kinds of ways. I mean, this is a ridiculous example, a deliberately ridiculous example. But very recently in Xinjiang, the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, a part of China where there's continuous efforts to make people feel part of the larger motherland, these are the winners of a competition to nibble a map of China out of flatbread, out of the big naan bread. That is used in that part of the world. So the materials that are being kind of used here are materials that are available in very large quantities, that exist in museums. But again, I think there's a particular history here that we might be missing, which is that almost all the materials, I'm going to talk about three, I'm going to talk about wood, I'm going to talk about porcelain, and I'm going to talk about steel, I'm going to talk about ceramics and steel. But none of these are traditionally esteemed materials. There's no connoisseurship or collecting of furniture in China prior to the 20th century. Indeed, in 1956, a famous furniture historian, or the first great furniture historian, Wang Shixiang, kind of had to say, look, foreigners are buying this stuff up and taking it out of the country because there's no law against doing that, because nobody cares about it. It doesn't actually come under the protection of a national heritage laws. It's only in the 1980s, the decade that Ai Weiwei spent in New York and that I spent as a Victoria and Albert Museum curator, that Chinese furniture starts to become a category within the art market and starts to gain significant prices. So he's working in wood. Here's a much, much bigger piece. His reworking of temple columns in this map of China, and here it is in its version with the province of Taiwan as well. Here's bed, the map of China unrolled, which we see in the exhibition, or these very beautiful, fantastically precisely crafted treasure box pieces, which again we see in the exhibition. They are, this is not a material that has been always, it's always been esteemed, but it's never been art. It's always been stuff within Chinese culture. And I'd want to make the same point, I think, about the particular kinds of ceramic that Ai Weiwei has dropped or painted or dipped in all kinds of other things. In that these are Chinese ceramics, and they're very, very old, but they're kinds of ceramics which historically, and by historically I mean prior to the 20th century, were not collected at all, were not valued, were not written about. Now, there are other kinds of ceramics that were valued and were written about, but these things are essentially, within China's own understanding of the past, were valueless until the 20th century. And I think we have to think about that when we're looking at the things that he does to this. Now, this is not some kind of apologia, it doesn't matter because, they are genuinely kind of extremely old pieces. But they're pieces that now exist in this kind of context, the context of a vast, unregulated antiques trade which has, which supports vast quantities of kind of destruction of the heritage, and which is ultimately aimed at markets kind of outside China in the West as well. So, we see this is the kind of thing that's going on here. Steel and porcelain, I think, ceramics are an interestingly sort of unreusable material. They're very different from wood. You can make a wooden thing into another thing, but you can't make a pot into something else. You can't melt it down, reuse the material. You can paint it, you can drop it, but you can't turn a pot that looks like that into a pot that looks like that, or long and thin. You just can't do that kind of thing. If we think about steel, and I found, I was looking at straight again in the exhibition and thinking, you know, the principal issue there is about weight and what's underneath it, obviously, the deaths caused by the earthquake. But I also thought about, you know, the particular role of steel in Chinese party mythology, in the world in which Ai Weiwei is growing up. You know, Nikolai Ostrovsky's novel, How the Steel Was Tempered. It's one of the great European novels to achieve huge popularity in China. It was made into various films. And here we have posters from the 50s. You know, steel is the kind of communist material par excellence, and associated with the notion of the Iron Man. You know, the party, you know, what the party creates is steel, and what the making of the steel creates is men of iron. This is Iron Man Wang, one of the great kind of heroes of the Cultural Revolution period. And so when we think about an issue, an image like this, this is a self-portrait Ai Weiwei made in 1986 in New York, with this kind of, cross-dressing kind of thing. I mean, I think there's a homage to, here's Man Ray's portrait of Rose C'est la Vie, which is Marcel Duchamp in his kind of cross-dressing alter ego. There's something like that going on here, but it brings us back to the kind of issue of gender in Ai Weiwei's work, in particular the relation between sex and looking. He said, sex is always an area through which you can see different moments in history with a certain clarity. And here's his photograph of his wife, Lu Qing, in Tiananmen Square in 1994. Interesting, there's an interesting thing here. This is always spoken about as a photograph by Ai Weiwei rather than as a performance piece by Lu Qing. Her agency is kind of elided in that, whereas there are plenty of other performance pieces done in Tiananmen Square where it's the person performing who is the artist and the person recording it who's anonymous. So there's a real issue here about the kind of silencing of the agency of women and the voices of women in what is still a very, very macho contemporary Chinese art world. So this kind of flashing, or, you know, peeping, or now you see it, now you don't aspect in Ai Weiwei is, I think, very important. This plays with the conventions, or it understands the conventions of the rock music video. We start in a very kind of realist mode, and at a certain point, it all goes a bit wacky. You know, how many music videos kind of do that? But I think it does something else as well. The realist mode at the beginning, which is what we've got reflected in the boxes, when we stand and we peep, we see these scenes, which is essentially what an audience outside China expects to see of the artist persecuted by the totalitarian state, watched as he goes to the bathroom and watched as he kind of eats and so on. So there's this kind of realist mode aspect of it. He himself has said of that work, I reduced it to half scale to make people feel that it's more like a play than a reality. But it seems to me that this does something kind of quite different in this significant scene where, you know, he's shaved. We then see him kind of, as it were, at liberty as the playboy in the suit, with the scantily dressed dancers, who again are a sort of cliche of the rock video. You know, the enviable lifestyle of the boss man, which is something that plenty of people kind of hold against him, that this is somebody who's kind of parlayed his position into this sort of international fame, which puts him up there with the glitterati. But why I think this video, I mean, and it's crude and noisy and it's not great music, but why I think it's actually a rather important work of art in understanding Ai Weiwei's kind of total situation, or in understanding his understanding of his total situation, is the ending where his son, shaves his beard, shaves his head, And he himself is done up in this kind of garish, overperformed kind of drag in the kind of corset and the thing. Because to put not too fine a point on it, the way that he's been presented in China by the state, and the way that many kind of commentators in China have chosen to see him as in some ways the tart of the Western audience, you know, the whore of the people like us who go and see exhibitions of his work outside China. And in a way, he's telling us both that he knows that, but he's also, you know, he blows the audience. This is YouTube, so it's a global audience. So he kind of blows us a kiss at the end to let us know that he's well aware that what we'd really like to see is purely the kind of, we like the bit at the beginning, because the bit at the beginning makes us feel good about ourselves, that we're not the horrible people who have kind of imprisoned him or are carrying out surveillance on him. But he's also very well aware that he's trapped, almost in the way that people in the early 20th century were trapped between, well, if it's modern, it can't be Chinese, and if it's Chinese, it can't be modern. He's in the situation where, he's either the victim, you know, he's the victim of both sets of gazes. And I think that, you know, the way he's chosen to do this for this exhibition, this again is about peeping, isn't it? We only see this if we peep, if we stand on the step, or if we lower our bodies in order to look in, you know, and we get the kind of frisson. So that again, the action is in us. We're stooping and climbing for that scopophiliac, that sort of joy of seeing something kind of naughty and forbidden, which is associated with the peep box. And I therefore think that he's, you know, again, he's taken something like the peep box, but also in the video, he's taken something like the conventions of the music video, which he's treated like a found object, like the coat hanger, which he bent out of shape and into something else. And it seems to me that it's that ability to continue to sort of bend things out of shape, to understand the properties of those materials sufficiently to be able to bend them out of the shape that they're in into another shape, that continues, for me at any rate, to make him an interesting artist, an artist worth thinking about and thinking with. And I'd like to thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about him this afternoon. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. For more information about the Royal Academy, please visit www.royalacademy.org.uk.